Hi, this is Scott Hamilton of Lehigh News. Welcome to another edition of 10 Minutes About. And today's episode is 10 Minutes About Boeing's Future. With me today as a special guest, John Pfluger, the president and CEO of Air Lease Corporation, one of the leading and most influential lessors in the business. Boeing, as we all know, has been in deep trouble since March of 2019 when worldwide 737 MAX fleet was grounded. And what was thought to be a grounding of only a few months has stretched to 21 months. During this period, the COVID crisis erupted, causing global demand for all airplanes to dry up. Deliveries of the 787, already slowed because of the political standoff between the Trump administration and China, also tanked. Certification of the 777X, which already was hobbled by weak demand, stalled, causing the grounding fall of the 737 MAX. Then in October of 2020, deliveries of the 787 paused as production anomalies were discovered. These have not resumed at this date. And in the meantime, Airbus has been recovering from the COVID impact. It's making a huge market gains at Boeing's expense. Boeing's market share of the bread and butter single aisle sector is down to the low 40 percentile in its competition with Airbus. And when all aircraft of all manufacturers in the 125-seat to 240-seat sector are factored in, Boeing's market share drops below 40%. The green movement is picking up. Airbus favors hydrogen. Boeing favors sustainable aviation fuel. Each approach has major challenges. With all of this as background, we're going to talk with John Pfluger about how Boeing, in his view, needs to move forward recover its once leading position in commercial aviation. And with this lengthy introduction, the clock is now ticking. Thank you, John, for joining us.
Well, thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me. You covered quite a bit in the introduction there. Let me just start by saying, you know, Air Lease Corporation and I do believe in Boeing products, and we've supported Boeing our whole careers and we'll continue to do so. But as you outlined, it's been a real challenging time for Boeing. It seemed that once the MAX got recertified, momentum had been gaining. Certainly the MAX aircraft in operation now are doing very well. There's high dispatch reliability. But unfortunately then we've fallen on the next challenge, which is the 787 quality escapements, which have led to a cessation of deliveries now for a year on that aircraft type. And it's unfortunate because the 787 is a good airplane, and one could make an argument that for today's marketplace, i.e. a smaller size twin-aisle long-haul aircraft, you know, it's probably one of the best, if not the best out there. And so to have a delivery cessation pause right now is very difficult. But the regulatory environment that's caused that pause also gives pause to the upcoming certifications that Boeing has pending. The 737-10 MAX being the first, and then the 777X being the second. So the question is, you know, you asked, what does Boeing have to do? Well, I think the first thing is that Boeing really does need to reestablish credibility with its customers, with those who buy the aircraft. And I think that with the current back-to-back problems, if you will, with the MAX and now the 787, when that airplane is being looked at with a fine-tooth comb, every unit that comes up for delivery is being looked at in a fine-tooth comb, not just by the regulators, by the way, but I would also say by Boeing's own process. Boeing has really revised and made a huge aspect of transparency. So a lot of the quality escapements are in fact being found by the Boeing company itself in the 787. But nevertheless, it does cause a little bit of doubt and pause for the next two airplanes on the certification list, that being the 10 MAX. And of course, that airplane, I would just remind you all, also has a slightly different gear system. It's got an articulating landing gear. And then of course, the 777X, the 9X, and if they do a freighter variant as well. I believe that airplane is gonna be flown for the first time over Dubai at the air show next week. Be interesting to see. But I think a step one, Scott, is restoring customer confidence that people won't be looking at lengthy delays for the current products that are set for certification. And that just simply means Boeing getting its house in order and being able to go through these certification processes without any big time surprises, that kind of a thing. There's some concern that the certification process for the 10 MAX might although I personally don't think this is a good case, might cause some additional findings on the Max series on a whole. I don't think that's been the case, or that will be the case, but I have heard that from a few airlines, and you can understand, you know, what would prompt that. So beyond that, in other words, getting Boeing's house in order, which they're trying very hard to do, I do know that, then comes the question, well, what comes next? The question most often asked is, how about competing with the A321neo, fabulously successful airplane in the marketplace, as well as the LR and the XLR variants, an airplane that's capturing the lower end of the wide body space now as well in transatlantic flying and that kind of. I don't think the question so much, Scott, is more towards the specific airplane, whether it's an answer to the A321neo, Boeing does have the 10 MAX. But the real question is, what game-changing design, what truly game-changing airplane can come out of this? I think it's less about the size and the specifically where it fits in the marketplace than it is the technology. And I think, should Boeing be looking at when they look at a new aircraft, and I don't really think it's been given a whole lot of thought right now, given all that's on the plane at the Boeing company. Understandably so. And we have also told Boeing, by the way, as a buyer, get your house in order first. But that does bring, when that happens, or as that happens, the technology. You mentioned sustainable fuel, aviation fuels, that can be used in current generation aircraft. I don't think there's much of a difference between Airbus and Boeing. Everybody agrees that SAF is really the near term obvious choice. It can be this kind of fuel, synthetic aviation fuel or sustainable aviation fuels, can be put in most current generation aircraft today, and that's a good thing. But it's limited, and you mentioned in your introduction there are significant challenges. And then there's hydrogen, which is, by all accounts, by all admission, by everybody, Airbus is farther away, and that requires some other trade offs. There's a lot more space in the fuselage that needs to be taken for hydrogen, whether it's hydrogen put in a gaseous form or a liquid form, that kind of thing. And there's another concept out there which actually does show a fair amount of promise from this revolution technology point of view. The challenge, of course, being, can we get another step change in fuel efficiency? Is the next airplane, can we produce one that is 20 to 25% more fuel efficient? And with today's engine technology, you know, it's doubtful. But there is a concept out there called the blended wing body, for example. You've probably heard of it. That by design, that airplane kind of looks like a big manta ray. It's blended wing body, meaning that really the fuselage is kind of blended into these large, thicker wings that hold a lot more fuel and possibly powered either conventionally or with an unducted fan, which some engine manufacturers are working on right now. And that airplane, by what I've seen, does show a 20 plus or even greater percent increase in fuel efficiency. But like every new design and challenge, that one has as well. First of all, that airplane has no windows. So the question being, are passengers willing, or would they be willing, to go on an airplane without windows? And there's some thought that, well, people are used to seeing video screens, so we can put video screens where the windows are, and that kind of thing. And the other thing is, because of the design of the airplane, the passengers sit much further out from the center of mass of the fuselage. And so therefore, when the airplane is turning left, banking left and right, you get much more of a sensation of movement and that kind of thing. So there are passenger appeal questions there, but certainly from a design concept engineering point of view, that's an airplane that could be built in the relatively near future. If it can be certified, but with its, you know, again, these challenges I pointed out and the passenger experience and whether the traveling public would accept that. So it really is, I think, a technology challenge for Boeing. And once they get the technology figured out, what might make best, then can be decisions upon what market segment is it. Is it closer to the A321 or perhaps a little bit bigger? Is it a family size kind of a thing, and that sort of thing. So Boeing's real big challenge, I think, is that it's not a specific aircraft targeted size and the product offering, it's the first and foremost the technology that needs to come first for it to have value. And of course, the final challenge with that is a big, big R&D program. Airlines are coming out of the worst crisis in airline history, where balance sheets have been devastated. Airlines have gone through huge financial losses, trying to build up their balance sheets now, trying to get passengers flying back. That's finally starting to happen. That's a great thing. But this is coming, you know, at a time when we have a lot of financial repair to do in the airline industry, and we shouldn't underestimate that. So this all speaks to price. At what pricing point could you deliver an aircraft like that? Whether it's to a leasing, through the leasing platform, to airline buyers, you know, in a environment that I think arguably for the next 3, 4, 5 years is going to be a financial recovery environment. You know, that'll be very, very important. So at the end of the day, I think in a nutshell, the short answer for Boeing is A, get your house in order first. B, do something blockbuster. One of the prior CEOs at Boeing said, we don't want any more moonshots. Well, it's hard to see the next airplane not being a moonshot from where I sit. And I would encourage Boeing to do that. I don't see another derivation of the MAX. Right now, again, the certification of the 10 MAX is really something that has to happen. But I think that's it. Get your house in order, number one, and then go out, be big, be bold, do something that none of us have thought about here. I've offered some different ideas and concepts here, but it's up to the Boeing company, and I believe they have the engineering talent. Don't forget, they've got a huge defense business. And I've got to think some of those technologies and some of these projects have got to be able to be applicable to the commercial side. Maybe it's just on the production side of it. Maybe it's in technology, materials, that sort of thing. But you've got to do something that addresses this next 20 or 30 years in a very meaningful way.
So we've actually already used up our 10 minutes. So we're obviously going to go longer than that. There was a lot to unpack with what you've talked about there, John. And in a way, I don't know where to begin. You had mentioned price. Well, price is cost. And we've heard not only the current Boeing CEO, David Calhoun, we heard his predecessor, Dennis Muilenburg, we heard his predecessor, Jim McNerney, talk about really doing a major makeover of the production system, which I've characterized as a moonshot for production and cost control. Do you have enough information or enough hints from Boeing as to just how big that production moonshot might be? And do you think that is what is needed to get you down to a cost level to drive that price level you're talking about?
Yeah, I do think it's needed. And I do think Boeing is every bit as wrapped around that aspect as the technology to produce an airplane that's yet another 20-25% more fuel efficient or equivalent. So I think that's taking big focus. I think Boeing learned a lot, opening up Charleston years ago for the 787. I think there's things yet to learn, perhaps even from the defense side of production, but I think clearly part of that equation has to be to revise the production system to lower overall costs. And how you do it, I'm not smart enough to figure out. I'm more of a finance guy instead of a production guy, but sitting on the board of a company that is a major, one of the largest suppliers of the Boeing company and produces fuselage sections and complex aerostructures, I can tell you, you know, it is not an easy task. But I think it's a task that Boeing must face, whether that's even producing airplanes in the United States or going outside of the United States, in terms of labor costs, et cetera. But it's a critical element.
Well, you talk about going outside the U.S., of course, there was the Embraer deal, and we all know what happened to that.
Yes.
And Brazil was a very low-cost area. We understand, of course, at least the obvious reason Boeing tanked that joint venture was because coronavirus had dried up all the deliveries at that point. The MAX was grounded. There was no end in sight. They had to preserve cash. But in the longer run, did Boeing make a mistake by withdrawing from the JV?
Well, it's hard to say in hindsight. If you step back, let's start just with the basics, money. Airbus acquired the 220 program for a dollar. Boeing, when they were looking at Embraer, it was much more normal commercialized number. I forget what the price tag was, et cetera. So
$4.5 billion.
Yeah, I mean, so that is not an inconsequential aspect as well. Today, I don't know what that deal would be like, but certainly the A220 program is accelerating nicely. We have 50 firm and 25 options, and our lease placements on the 220 have been accelerating. The airplane is catching good traction in the marketplace. It's going to take the place of a lot of A319s, 737, 700s. And of course, in the future, there may be a derivative like the 220-500, although I don't think it's on Airbus's radar screen yet, but that airplane is certainly out there. So in terms of the entire product line, there was a nice parallel elegance, I would call it, from Airbus absorbing the 220 and the notion that Boeing would have had the regional platform covered with Embraer. So time will tell if it was a mistake or not. I think Embraer continues to produce well, sell fairly well into the marketplace. But you know, it's a big difference paying $4.5 billion versus zero.
Yeah, now I will say that Airbus has had to spend a little bit more money. They bought out Bombardier's share.
Yeah,
Bombardier couldn't pay for building the FAL. And, you know, so it did that $1 turned out to be quite a few more, but be that as it may. When you and I talked very briefly at the IATA AGM in Boston in early October, you outlined a concept for a solar-powered airplane that is intriguing but seems replete with technical challenges. I'd like to have you go back and talk a little bit about your concept here.
Well, the concept basically is very much like a Toyota Prius. You have conventional powered aircraft, but there is nothing that says, for example, that the upper fuselage section, the upper sections of the wing could not be embedded with solar cells, solar generating panels of some sort. Now, we know that these are fuselage structural elements of the aircraft design, but that doesn't mean you could not put in there some kind of a solar panel so that you don't have to have quite as much electrical generating power on the aircraft. You have a means to store power more in batteries. You might not need so much from thrust from the APU. You know, these things, the integrated drive generators, or IDGs as we call them, take a lot of energy to run to produce this power. So significantly reducing reliance on internally generated electric power and having some more reliance on solar power is one avenue. I agree. It's a concept only, and has, I'm sure, many, many technical challenges. But it is something that has been discussed and is out there. It's just, you know, one of all these different things that we've talked about: hydrogen and sustainable aviation fuels and electric hybrid technology. And don't forget, for example, on the 787. It's really the first commercial airliner of recent decades that doesn't start by pneumatic power, air power. It starts electrically. And when I first flew the 787, the very first test airplane, the test pilot on engine start, you know, I was looking for, having flown jets for so many years, you know, I was looking for bleed air pressure that you normally use to start the engines. And I'm looking around for the bleed air pressure gauge, and he goes, "No bleed air, it's all electric, remember?" And so we watched the start sequence, and you see these generators, when you push the start button, just go massively power output to get these things going. And so that could be supplemented by, you know, battery storage that it's accumulated through, also through solar panels. Look, these are concepts that are fun to talk about, but I'm not an engineer, and we're not engineers, and we know that concepts cost money to turn into reality. But I think the good part about it is, you know, nothing nothing is completely off the table. I mean, all of these things are being discussed in the engineering circles, I think, by some very smart, talented people who do know what they're doing. And hopefully through some iteration of ideas and collaboration, one or more or a combination of these things may work. For example, what if you had sustainable aviation fuel coupled with additional electrical generating power through solar cells or solar panels? I don't know. But it's just fun to chat about all these different things.
Now, ALC and of course, your predecessor company, ILFC, has always worked very closely with the manufacturers, the airframe and the engine mm-hmm. manufacturers, mm-hmm. about development of new airplanes, new engines, and so on. Today, we have GE talking about its new open fan, they call it, open rotor by another name, the RISE program. Mm-hmm. Pratt Whitney, when I saw them at IATA last month, still is committed to the GTF and evolution mm-hmm. of the GTF. Rolls-Royce, which may or may not be in business for all the financial problems that it's having, nevertheless, has been working on the advanced engine and the ultrafan engine. Mm-hmm. As somebody who has been so involved in airplane and engine development for decades, how would you kind of look at these three concepts, the advanced ultrafan, the GTF, and the open fan engines? Where do you see, based on what information you have, which is probably quite incomplete, where do you see the most opportunity here for step changes?
Yeah. So look, I think part of it is that we have to look at these again with open minds and open concept of achievement. Now, typically speaking and historically, the unducted fans, the open rotors, if you call it, has typically never quite hit the mark from a variety of reasons, and one of them being passengers not liking to see propellers anymore on big commercial airliners, big lawnmower fans that they used to call them. And, you know, there is issues on that technologies with ice protection and then what the biggest, of course, is what happens if a blade lets go. Today's cowled engines, the cowling is supposed to try and protect a blade separation. We know that doesn't always work, but for the most part, it kind of works. But I think it's important not to be stuck in a historical perspective and look at each of these technologies. So sitting here today, it's very hard to predict what may happen with the RISE engine or the Rolls-Royce or the Pratt or the Rolls-Royce ideas. But I just think we have to keep an open mind and not necessarily be unfairly biased. Well, that didn't work 10 years ago or 15 years ago or 20 years ago, so probably it's not going to work today. I would remind you that the gearing of engines was seen very negatively as Pratt was coming up with the geared turbofan concept. And gearing of engines, typically, for those that have been in the business for 30, 40 years, that was also a concept that was frowned upon. Didn't want that gearing, didn't want the problems with the gearing, didn't want the maintenance headache with the gearing. And it turns out, for the geared turbofan, the gearing is actually fine. The gearing has not been the problem on the development of that engine and the initial introduction of that engine into service. The gearing has been okay. So I mention that because in the past, you would have said, no, stay away from a geared engine, but it looks like it's working. And probably will be considered by GE and possibly Rolls-Royce and other variations of engines as well as a step function change, because gearing is a way that you can increase, and that's the way that the geared turbofan worked. So I think the bottom line is to keep an open and fresh perspective. It's hard, it's premature for me to, and I just don't know what's going to be the most successful, but I'm a curious person by nature, and I think we need to just keep an open curiosity, open a certain amount of skepticism, certainly from lessons learned in the past and past perceptions. But today we can't afford not to look at any of these new technologies.
So we have run long by design here. I'm going to end this with one last question, I think, which actually may become a couple as depending on your answer. Is the 777X going to be more than a niche airplane in Boeing's future?
That's a tough one. Certainly the market acceptance has been slow on that aircraft. And today, you know, one of the fundamental aspects of that airplane, it may be technologically advanced, you know, the lowest cost fuel burn per seat mile, that kind of thing. But it's also the biggest airplane. It'll be the biggest twin engine out there. And it takes a lot of bodies to fill that airplane. And today, in the next 3 to 4 years, in a COVID recovery mode, while I do believe passenger traffic will come back very, very strongly, the price of the airplane is also very, very high. And so the size and the price, I think, have been, have caused some pause by some carriers. Now, obviously, the launch customers of the 777X, the largest, biggest airlines in the world, do see a role for that airplane going forward. And I'm sure it'll be a great airplane once it's really done and certified. We have not taken a position in the 777X at Air Lease Corporation. We just have not seen as clear a future, I think, for that aircraft as we would like to see, both in terms of the numbers of customers, the numbers that have been sold, and of course, it has to be certified. So it's not to say we would never do it, but so far we have held off. So I don't know. I can't predict 10 years down the road or 15 years down from the road. I just don't see it that clearly ahead. But I think certainly it is a program that certainly for the last couple of years, the lack of sales on that aircraft demonstrates kind of a pause and reevaluation by the marketplace.
What I see about the airplane is that just as the market moved beyond the A380 and the 747 with smaller hub-to-point airplanes, mm-hmm. I see even more of that happening now since the 777X program was launched in 2013. You've got a new and improved A330neo, set mm-hmm. aside the market demand for that. You now have single-aisle airplanes that can do anywhere between 8 and 12 hours that you didn't mm-hmm. have in 2013. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me the market has moved beyond that. And with that, John, I would love to continue the conversation. We've gone long. It's always great to talk to you, and thanks very much.
Great, Scott. And